In late 1988, the unusual case of the hacker spies landed squarely, if also fairly arbitrarily, in the hands of Eckhart Kohlhaas, one of a handful of federal prosecutors at the Attorney General's office in Karlsruhe who worked espionage cases. The diffident 43-year-old prosecutor had recently arrived at his post after several years in the public prosecutor's office in Karlsruhe, followed by a stint at the Ministry of Justice in Bonn, where he had worked on hostage cases. He didn't know whether or not to consider himself lucky to have this high-profile case. It was a first for his small department. Not only was there no precedent in the Federal Republic for such activity, but there was no precedent anywhere. Moreover, West Germany's Attorney General was placing an unusual amount of significance on the case. It smacked of an entirely new brand of espionage. If indeed military secrets had been stolen from U.S. computers and delivered to the Soviets, as well as hundreds of logins and passwords, the case could prove to be explosive. Kohlhaas, whose spare office betrayed his avoidance of anything so technical as even a typewriter, was rather intimidated by the technology and the technical matters surrounding the case. He joked with others that spelling computer was challenging enough for him. Suddenly, he was faced with the task of prosecuting a ring of young men whose esoteric endeavors, breaking into computers thousands of miles away and stealing information, he had trouble comprehending. But he decided to ignore, for the most part, his technical limitations and focus on the espionage involved. After all, whether they had downloaded information destined for the KGB from computers in the Far East or photocopied it was immaterial. Espionage was espionage. The Bundeskriminalamt and the Secret Service had distinct interests in the case. The last time the Secret Service and the police had been one and the same was during the Third Reich. To prevent even the possibility of another Gestapo, the two agencies had been completely separated. Not only is communication between the two entities minimal, but they tend to compete with one another. To the Secret Service, this was an interesting and novel case that it would have liked to keep for itself. The Attorney General, who worked with the Bundeskriminalamt, simply wanted to see justice prevail. Unlike the Secret Service, the prosecutors were not about to promise anything like amnesty to an informant. It was Prosecutor Kohlhaas's assignment to build a case against the three suspects based primarily upon the claims of two somewhat unreliable informants. In fact, the credibility of the two young men was a matter of some concern. The one with the nickname of Hagbard was a drug addict from Hanover who had been in and out of psychiatric hospitals and drug rehabilitation centers. During his full-day interrogations, Hagbard could remain alert for half an hour at most before his head began to fall toward his chest. His hands trembled, and occasionally he excused himself to take pills of some kind. Only the medication, coupled with copious quantities of sweets and coffee, helped keep him fully conscious. Moreover, he seemed to have trouble remembering dates and details of any kind. Eventually, if he was given long enough to concentrate, he could reconstruct an important event, or remember the name of a computer he had broken into. At the bottom of the transcript of one interrogation, the young man had signed a disclaimer stating that the medication he was on made it difficult for him to articulate his thoughts clearly. Hagbard's friend Pengo, who had followed closely on Hagbard's heels to the West German authorities, had his own idiosyncrasies. He was clearly very bright, more direct and lucid in his police interrogations, and certainly more in command of his faculties, but his manner was unspeakably arrogant. Here was a young computer hacker under investigation for a crime against the state who displayed no regret whatever for his actions. When Pengo was summoned to Karlsruhe to restate his police testimony before a court magistrate, the judge asked the young hacker who would pay for the thousands of marks worth of connection time that had accrued from all the stolen newies. "I don't know," came Pengo's response. "It's not my problem." Kohlhaas suspected that it wasn't so much a moral imperative or even a vague sense that he had done something wrong that prompted Pengo to unburden himself to the West German authorities, but a fear that his friend Hagbard had already done so. More irksome still than Pengo's hubris was his curious lapse of memory when it came to the magnetic tape. The prosecutor simply couldn't believe that someone who fancied himself a superior hacker and who wanted to make a favorable first impression on a KGB agent would hand over a magnetic tape filled with data without knowing what the data were. Kohlhaas had little doubt that Pengo was protecting someone, most likely the Hamburg hacker who called himself Obelix. And there were places where Hagbard's version of events differed markedly from Pengo's. Hagbard insisted that it was not just lists of computers that went to Sergei, but hundreds of computer logins and passwords to highly sensitive military computers as well. Pengo admitted that he had often given logins to Hagbard in the past, but he doubted that the information he gave to Hagbard eventually made its way to Sergei. And while Pengo insisted that his share of the money from Sergei had come to no more than 5,000 marks, or $2,500 at the very most, Hagbard claimed that Pengo had got at least three times that. In order to bring some outside proof to bear on the claims of the two young informants, Kohlhaas decided to initiate some surveillance on Marcus Hess and Peter Karl in Hanover, and Dob Brzezinski in Berlin. He also ordered telephone taps, but very little came from them. From the start, perhaps to keep Pengo guessing, the West German officials wouldn't let him know what lay in store for him. Pengo's lawyer kept up a steady correspondence with the authorities, urging them to view his client's confession as a demonstration that cooperation between hackers and the state could yield positive results. In this case, the containment of a new form of espionage. The three journalists, in the meantime, were preparing their television broadcast on the hacker spy case. They crisscrossed West Germany, interviewing everyone from the head of the Secret Service to members of the Chaos Computer Club. They dispatched a correspondent in the United States to interview Stoll at his Berkeley laboratory. They took their cameras to East Berlin and produced footage of the building that housed Sergei's office. And they even asked Pengo to sit for an interview. The authorities had warned Pengo time and again not to talk with television journalists. For once, common sense prevailed. Delighted though he usually was to talk, this time he turned them down. By the end of 1988, Peter Karl sensed that he was being watched. During a visit to Sergei's just after the first of the year, Karl passed on detailed reports of the latest security incident that had swept through the U.S. It was the case of a computer virus released by Robert Tappan Morris, a graduate student at Cornell University. Morris had unleashed his program one evening in November of 1988. Within hours, it had crashed computers at universities and research institutions throughout the U.S., alerting the nation to the vulnerability of its computer networks. The West German hackers assumed that anything that had been so quick and devastating would be of considerable interest to the Soviets. In addition to their virus report, Karl gave Sergei a virus report written by Cliff Stoll. At the end of their usual repast, the KGB officer told Karl that a pause might be in order. For one thing, Sergei said, Mikhail Gorbachev was coming soon to visit East Berlin. With so many players involved, the security of the operation was already low. The last thing the Russians wanted was to have an espionage operation exposed while the Soviet leader was in town. Sergei's second reason for halting their meetings was that he was fairly certain that the Western intelligence had its eyes on Karl's movements, but he assured Karl that the operation was just being placed in temporary abeyance. When Karl reported back to Hess that Sergei had called for a hold on the action, Hess was a little bit relieved. The whole affair had long since lost its attraction for him, and the best he could hope for now was to see the entire thing disappear. There had already been a couple of close calls. First, there was the initial scare in the summer of 1987 when Bremen police had traced calls to his telephone. Then there was the rush of publicity in April 1988 when the Quick story appeared describing Cliff Stoll's hunt for the hacker inside Berkeley Laboratory. But since then, everything had quieted down. Hess had a new job as a programmer at a publishing firm in Hanover, and it was going well. It just seemed that the money he had made from this entire KGB business, about $9,000, was too little to risk continuing.